Hey, y'all, how's it going? All right. Well, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Oh, yeah, I need that. How's everybody doing? Yeah, whatever. I can't hear you. It's libertarian foreign policy mostly, which means I hate the empire, and I'm trying to get you to hate the empire, too. To that end, I'm interviewing journalists about the stuff that they write about the empire and what it's doing. That's basically the gig. Today on the show, Yosef Butt, the nuclear physicist, is going to be on the show to debunk the Parchin, the phony, false Parchin accusations one last time. I tried to get Robert Kelly on the show. He's the expert's expert, man. He's the former chief IAEA weapons inspector and has written, I don't know, 5 or 6 times about Parchin, including a recent one for CIPRI.org that Yosef's article is based on, really. But Robert Kelly, why he won't give me or you the time of day, I don't know why. But, oh well. That's cool, because I still read the thing he wrote. He's obviously right. And Yosef will do the show, and he's a nuclear physicist, so he's got that authoritative voice on this stuff, too. So that's coming on. One last final debunking of the Parchin BS. And then that should be it. I think we're done. Parchin, maybe. Yeah, right. Well, when the test results come back, we'll have that too for the follow-up. And then Dan Sanchez is going to be back on the show. Dan Sanchez of the Mises Academy at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. That's where they are more free market than you, no matter who you are. They are as free market as humans can be. They're the Ludwig von Mises Institute for Austrian School Economics. And Dan, he's also our newest writer, our newest regular columnist at antiwar.com. And good thing, too, because I really like the stuff he writes. And you guys got to read the one today. You know, I admit, I refer to this thing all the time. But it's been years since I read it. And I'm so glad that Dan went back and reviewed Coping with Crumbling States by David Wurmser. Uh-oh, we've got a stray italics tag on the page here somewhere. What happened? Oh, I see. Yeah, we got to fix that. Anyway, great piece today at antiwar.com, guys. Seize the Chaos. Israel, the neocons, and their bloody, blundering art of war. Oftentimes you'll hear me paraphrasing David Wurmser on the show. We must expedite the chaotic collapse in Syria. Only if you're an idiot. But, okay, that counts for the neocons. They knew they were right because they were too stupid to stop and think about it for a minute. So they knew they were right. Seize the Chaos, Israel, the neocons, and their bloody, blundering art of war. That's Dan Sanchez coming up a little bit later on the show. Tonight, Jeff Tucker and I are doing another episode of Eye on the Empire. And, you know, we never did get around to talking about the boom and bust cycle and what that has to do with foreign policy. Nothing, right? Yeah, so should be a little bit of that. That is tonight at liberty.me. Liberty.me. It's like Facebook, but for libertarians. You can write your own articles and publish them there. It's better than Facebook, man. It's a real cool thing. You ought to go and sign up. It's just $5 a month. No ads. Virtually all anarchists. I guess there's some minarchists too, but And great kind of content on there. Sheldon Richman is there. Lucy Steigerwald and Sheldon have a show. I have two shows on there, one with Jacob Hornberger, one with Jeffrey Tucker. And there's a bunch of other stuff on there, man. Rachel Mills, formerly of Ron Paul's Office, has a politics show on there. And check it out, man. It's liberty.me. Tonight, 8 Eastern time, it'll be me and Jeff Tucker for Eye on the Empire. Yeah. Also, last night, I should mention, last night, Angela Keaton and I were both interviewed for the Anti-Media podcast. If you want to check that out, it's at theantimedia.org. And pretty sure they keep all their archives there. Hang on, I gotta yawn. Yeah, you'll like it, man, maybe. I don't know. It's an interview of me. An interview of Angela. Check it out at, the Anti-Media. Okay, good. When we get back from this break here, we're gonna talk about Afghanistan and the bombing of the hospital and then, get back to Syria and Russia and all that stuff. Oh, Palestine, man, I got a ton of Palestine stories for you today. You're gonna be pissed off. But first, as long as I'm very short on time for this segment, I just wanted to point to this article at McClatchyDC.com. Faltering Rand Paul campaign gets another blow. They mean that in a bad way. In the last quarter, he raised $2.5 million. $2.5 million in 3 months. Far behind his Republican rivals. Ben Carson raised $20 million. The latest Paul number is well below the $7 million he took in from April through June, and reflects his sagging standing in recent polls. He has 2.3% support in the latest RealClearPolitics.com September 17th through 28th poll average. That gets him a 10th place showing and could jeopardize his standing in the next Republican debate. In other words, he might not even be allowed to participate. And the problem is, I've seen quotes from his people, too, talking about, well, you know, they have a few people who are loyal enough to keep them going at very low levels for a long, long time. That's a really bad idea. I wish he'd just drop the Republican presidential nomination thing and just try to go back to the Senate seat. He may not even keep his Senate seat at this point. And, you know, the thing is it's too late, too. He would have had to listen to me years ago. Everybody said, Scott Horton, you just don't understand politics. He can't be good like his dad, or else he can't win. But if he compromises and becomes more Republican, then he can win and be the president, and then he can do good things. And I said, he cannot be the president. Rand Paul cannot be the president. Jesus Christ, have we not just lived through the Bush and Obama years and Clinton before that? You think this is a democracy or a limited republic or some nonsense? This is the evil empire, okay, run by a criminal oligarchy. And no, Rand Paul cannot be the president of the United States. He cannot win the nomination. He cannot be the president. You know what he could have done? He could have run as his dad, only younger and a little bit more articulate, and in the Senate. And he could have turned the world upside down. He could have fought the good fight rhetorically and changed millions of Americans forever the way his father did. And instead he pissed it all away and exchanged got nothing but defeat and disgrace. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, all, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, guys, welcome back. Can you guys keep up with the different excuses for bombing the Afghan hospital? The Doctors Without Borders hospital there? I'm trying, but I can't keep up. I think first they said Americans on the ground were under attack there and called in the strike. And then they said, well, they were attacking Taliban targets nearby. And it was just accidental collateral damage. And then they said, no, we were bombing the place, but the strike was called in by the Afghans, so it's their fault. Hey, stupid, why are you hitting yourself? Why are you hitting yourself? And then I think I'm missing one. I may have them out of order, too. But I just saw Jim Mikuláczewski on MSNBC. I've been taken to watching Andrea Mitchell lately. Andrea Mitchell Greenspan. You know, so she can tell me what's true and stuff like that. It's great fun. Anyway, so Jim Mikuláczewski was on there. And he was saying, okay, it was American Special Forces that called in the strike. And they called in the strike from an AC-130 gunship. That was who was doing the killing. Mikuláczewski, by the way, he's NBC's Pentagon spokesman, reporter guy for many years now. And he says somewhere it was a mistake. It was a miscommunication. Someone screwed up. But the general, I think he's citing Cartwright. He said there was a mistake somewhere, but he wouldn't say where. But apparently, according to Mikuláczewski, he knows who screwed up and why and how. And that's their story and they're sticking to it. For now. Until they change it to something else. You know who I bet called in the airstrike? Those little kids in the ICU that burned to death. They said, hey, Democrats, come and liberate us. Give us a government in a box. Clear, hold, and build, and change our entire society. Please come. And then they burned to death. And that sound like the most plausible explanation to you? The children, the already wounded children of Afghanistan crying for America to come and change their entire society. Clear, hold, and build me, they cry as they die. Anyway, so that's the latest I've heard from their excuses. Doctors Without Borders says, you're skirting responsibility. You know, you should have heard this thing I heard on NPR yesterday. You guys ever listen to NPR radio? Man, is it something else. It's like they're broadcasting from the State Department. And, you know, I've been at this a long time, but it seems to me like it's getting more and more blatant. Like their BS is just so freaking obvious. And it just seems like on the obvious level, it seems like the space between the State Department and TV news is just shrinking and shrinking and shrinking more and more all the time. See, then I started thinking about Andrea Mitchell again. What the hell was I going to say? Oh, well, it doesn't matter. What was it, man? Sharing your thought. I should do that on the radio more often. Forget what the hell I'm in the middle of talking about. Here's an important point to make instead of the one I was going to. According to Doctors Without Borders, Medicine Sans Frontiers here, they've been getting harassed by Afghan military previously. to a couple of months ago. The hospital appears to have previously been the target of a violent intrusion by armed members of Afghan special forces in July, disturbing enough to warrant the release of an official statement condemning the behavior and drawing attention to an unacceptable breach of international humanitarian law. It is unclear what response... Oh, I know what it was. That was what threw me off at the NPR thing. It's because I was thinking about TV. I couldn't get my brain to connect me back to fucking radio. That was what was the joke. What I was listening to might as well have been broadcasting from the State Department. Well, I used to respect, the expert guest said, I used to respect Doctors Without Borders. Huh. But now that they have accused America of war crimes, I no longer respect this organization. How dare they accuse America of war crimes before the investigation is complete? And in fact, the NPR guy was a little bit incredulous. And I don't think he was just playing devil's advocate. He says, you know, but the bombing went on for an hour. I mean, doesn't that kind of answer whether it was deliberate or not? Oh, no. Not only does he think that it's way too soon to decide whether this was illegal under war crimes law, because, hey, it just depends how many Taliban were in there and how many innocent victims die. It's a calculation of whether it's worth it or not. There's no blanket restriction on America bombing hospitals, which I wonder if that's even true at all. Obviously, the Americans are the most powerful force, so there is no law that rules their behavior. They're law enforcement immune, just like all the cops in America, but on the international level. But that was the part that really got me, was not only was this guy saying, oh my goodness, I think it's too soon to say if this was an actual war crime or not. Very, very sad, but illegal? Why? I just don't know if we're there yet. He actually had to go to the extent and say, Doctors Without Borders, yeah, an organization I used to have respect for until they dared to accuse America of committing war crimes. Well, just because there's 22 dead people, 33-something wounded, including children burned to death, including doctors killed. Oh, my land, such language, war crimes, oh, that couldn't be it. In fact, you know, your accusation that this is a war crime is far more offensive to me than, you know, the actual dead and maimed people, by far, said the, whoever the guy was, the government spokesman on NPR News. But anyway... Geez, I guess they have a point. If the place was crawling with all of the top leadership of the Taliban and there were no patients in there, or I don't know, maybe just one, and that one patient was, I don't know, really old and was going to die anyway, then that'd be fine, right? Except that, no, that'd be murder. And also, Medicines Sans Frontiers is on the record saying there were no Taliban fighters at all anywhere. We sure as hell didn't call you and say, protect us from the Taliban. We called you and said, please call off your assault. And you wouldn't. And what kind of accident is that when they're on the phone for half an hour saying, stop bombing us? And also, they're bombing them for half an hour, for an hour, and they only killed 33? Boy, the Americans really suck at war, huh? Is that the new female Rangers up there flying the C-130, or how do they do that? Can't even kill kids in a hospital, you suck so bad. I mean, some, but... Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. And they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Thanks, guys. Brand new Barrett Brown article out. It's called Stop Sending Me Jonathan Franzen Novels. I don't know who that is. I don't read fiction. All right, I'll probably read the book episode 7 when it comes out. But other than that, all right, I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Ray was supposed to do the show, but boy, if we're not just suffering conflicts of time, schedule difficulties and things this week with Ray. Sure wanted to talk with him. You know what, man? I want to watch this thing, and I think you guys probably want to hear it too. It's an interview from RT. I'm just going to rewind it just a little bit here. It's an interview with Michael Flynn, former general, retired general Michael Flynn. He was the chief of the DIA. That's the Defense Intelligence Agency. And he's we've covered him on the show before. We did an interview, you might have heard, with Brad Hoff from the Levant Report, who also has posted this this interview now. He posted before Flynn did an interview with Al Jazeera, where he confirmed the importance of that DIA memo. Yes, there are a million little snowflakes floating around the Pentagon that don't mean anything, but this memo was important. It made it to Michael Flynn's desk. He knew exactly what it was, what it was about, what it said, and claimed in the interview with Al Jazeera that he took it with him to the White House to make the case that, hey, just so you know, you're fighting for Al-Qaeda in Syria right now, dude, back in 2012. And so here he is interviewed on RT, and the discussion goes that direction, and this is right around where I had to stop. Oh, well, actually, here, let me cue it up to where it's advised. Maybe we'll go rewind a little bit. Oh, Jesus, at the very end where they talk about it? 16, 18, yeah. All right, let's see here.
We didn't, and now we have a whole
We look at the mess in this whole region now. We heard the warnings from Damascus just in the last 24 hours from Assad himself saying, you know, the whole future of the Middle East is basically on the balance here. It's got to be sorted out. But, you know, you look at this previously classified, now out, Defense Intelligence Agency memo from 2012. It said there's a possibility of establishing a Salafist principality in eastern Syria. That's exactly what the supporting powers of the opposition want. That was the wording of it. All this was planned out from the start, yeah?
Yeah, Kevin, the assessments, the intelligence assessments that I know the military intelligence have been providing, I believe we're very accurate, and actually what you're talking about there, you know, I obviously don't see the report, but I know.
Did America allow the rise of ISIL
here? And the reason, Kevin, the reason why it's accurate is because we've had 10 years. We had 10 years prior of guys and you know, men and women on the battlefield that were watching and fighting these guys. I mean, they didn't go away. They actually expanded. They expanded, in some cases, doubling in size and capacity and numbers of groups and things like that, not just in Syria and Iraq and in places like Yemen, but all throughout North Africa. We now see this incursion of migrants into Europe. Mm. And we know, again, from our own FBI director's comments, we have the problem right here in the United States. And I know, as Russia knows, they have the same problems on their southern periphery there with the rise of the radical elements of the Muslim community.
Michael, it's been a pleasure to have you on the program. We could talk to you for hours here. Maybe you can come back and chat to us at some point.
You know, here, I want to cue it back up to like 9-something because that was pretty interesting here, too. Oh, here he's. They start with this Biden clip here. Let's do that.
Since if you look at what Joe Biden had to say, what, a year ago, let's just listen to that and then we'll bring it up to date.
The fact of the matter is the ability to identify a moderate middle in Syria there was no moderate middle, because the moderate middle are made up of shopkeepers, not soldiers.
All right. Well, let's bring it up to date. If there's no moderate middle in Syria, who is Washington willing to support then? Who are these people, that the moderate fighters they've been talking about?
Well, you cannot, you know, when we talk about training forces to fight these guys, that's one thing. And that's a very tactical issue. What we're really talking about is politically, you know, is there a coherent, solid political movement with leaders who can be respected at an international forum that actually could lead the country of Syria? And I can't sit here today, Kevin, and tell you who those leaders are. Do they exist? I mean, if it's a bunch of guys, you know, as described by the vice president, who are shopkeepers or whatever the other context of his comments were, I mean, those aren't individuals who can necessarily are ready to take over the government. But that said, I do believe that President Assad eventually is going to have to go. And I don't think that's a disconnect from the way President Putin looks at Syria as well. I mean, over the long haul, the situation has to be stabilized. And I think that what we've seen is we've seen Russian red lines crossed and to the point where now Russia has taken military action, which I think is a big, that's a huge, huge step in the complexity of this situation.
All right. Now, so here's something I want to talk about. Again, with this DIA memo, just type in DIA memo Syria and you'll find Levant Report and all the coverage there. It's very important here. If you're not familiar, you can look that up. And remember, we had Julian Borger on the line 1 week ago, right? Or was it two? And Julian Borger, yeah, 1 week. Well, I don't know. Whenever the hell it was, man. Week before last, I guess. And Borger at The Guardian said, yeah, you know, the Russians said we can negotiate Assad's ouster here. Let's do this in February of 2012. And the Americans refused to go along with it. But you know what? This interview here is from the very beginning of March. This must just be, you know, within a week or two after telling the Russians, no, we don't want to negotiate the exit of Assad from Syria. We'd rather have a war. Hillary was interviewed on CBS News. You hear this clip at the top of the show every day here on the show if you listen to the live show. It was CBS News. And, of course, the entire narrative was, why aren't we doing more to help the rebels overthrow Assad? And so here's Hillary defending Obama's so-called do-nothing policy, even though we know Phil Giraldi reported in December 2011, 3 months before, that there was a brand new finding, and we already knew all year long that the Saudis and British and French special forces and CIA were already over there and everything anyway. But anyway, so here's Hillary saying, here's why we're not doing more to overthrow Assad.
We know al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria? So I think, Wyatt, you know, despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad, if you're a military planner or if you're a secretary of state and you're trying to figure out, do you have the elements of an opposition that is actually viable, we don't see that.
Yeah, there you go. Just like Flynn just said, we don't see that. The opposition, yeah, it's al-Qaeda. The president himself, who's been behind this policy all along, and he's not as bad on it as Hillary would have had him been, but still, Obama himself admitted to Thomas Friedman a year and a couple of months ago that, quote, the notion that arming the rebels would have made a difference, meaning the so-called moderate FSA, would have made a difference, has always been a fantasy. This is a direct quote of the president here admitting, this idea that we could provide some light arms or even more sophisticated arms to what was essentially an opposition made up of former doctors, farmers, pharmacists, and so forth, and that they were going to be able to battle not only a well-armed state, but also a well-armed state backed by Russia, backed by Iran, backed by a battle-hardened Hezbollah, that was never in the cards. And he, of course, he's not even mentioning there, oh yeah, and they're supposed to thwart and defeat and destroy the al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State at the very same time, too, huh? What a ridiculous joke, admitted the President of the United States. And they just carry on. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show.
I have regrets my regret is that a violent group of people have risen up again. This is Al-Qaeda plus.
I swear the only thing that I did to that is cut Bob Schaefer out of it. Bob Schaefer tries to interrupt to help the poor man for a minute there. I cut that part out. The rest of that, that's just, yeah. By the way, I should play this more often. And you know what? I'm not sure why it's edited this way. I have one that's called edit and one that's not called edit version. But, neither of them include the great question by Ben Swan, I don't believe. Ben Swan, the libertarian journalist, he confronted Barack Obama in 2012, shortly after that Hillary Clinton clip that I played. Would have been April or May, I guess. Did I say 12? Wait, do I mean 12 or 11? Yeah, it was 12. Spring of 2012, Ben Swan gets to ask a couple of questions of the president. And he says, right now, you have a drone war going on. We're still fighting in Afghanistan. We've got a drone war in Pakistan and in Yemen against Al-Qaeda. But how do you square that with support for the rebels in Syria that includes Al-Qaeda? Ben Swan asked that to the President of the United States.
I share that concern. What we've done is to say we will provide non-lethal assistance to Syrian opposition leadership that are committed to a political transition, committed to an observance of human rights. We're not going to just dive in and get involved with a civil war that, in fact, involves some elements of people who are genuinely trying to get a better life, but also involve some folks who would, over the long term, do the United States harm.
Right. See, so it's just like in the clip of Hillary Clinton. There's a complete and total and open acknowledgement of the danger of what they're doing. There's no reason to be surprised what's in that DIA report. And yet Obama's lying his ass off saying we're not going to dive in and get involved in this war. I mean, it's kind of true that, yes, he has been more reluctant than others in his administration. But I don't even really know reluctant is the right thing. I think he's been completely determined to follow a path of lesser conflict. I don't think he wants to overthrow Assad. I don't think he ever wanted to overthrow Assad. But he likes seeing him fight. I think he probably made an agreement with the Israelis. They told the New York Times on the front page of the New York Times that, yeah, we want to see both sides continue to hemorrhage. Of course, that means a bunch of civilian casualties too, but screw them, right? And I think that's been the policy here is, I think at first it was regime change and then it changed to, well, sure. A Salafist principality in the East, why not? I'll take Assad down 2/3 of a peg anyway, ain't that enough? Without outright giving Damascus to Al-Qaeda? But was Obama providing some non-lethal aid? Yeah, and a bunch of lethal aid too. It was right in the New York Times. Bunch of automatic rifles from Croatia. And that's just what they admitted in the Times. And of course, then TOW missiles and all kinds of other stuff from the Saudis. That's all American equipment. Jonathan Landay has been on this show, said, I've seen the CIA training these guys in Jordan. Just go, hell, you can go to the pro warmongers like Small Wars Journal and see them outraged. Is it Blogs of War or Small Wars Journal? I'm thinking of, I think it's Small Wars Journal, where they're going, oh my God, look, the FSA has given our weapons to Al Qaeda. Here's Al Qaeda firing tow missiles at Assad's forces. Here's 10,000 examples of American-backed, American-trained, American-financed, American-armed forces fighting alongside Al-Qaeda in battle. Arar al-Sham, that's just the more Saudi-backed version of Al-Qaeda, while al-Nusra gets more money from the Turks, I guess. But, you know, back when Flint Leverett would still do the show, I don't know why they quit talking to me. I don't think I really did anything to him, but anyway. Flint Leverett, I asked him, I was trying to be polite. I said, look, man, the Saudis are doing this, the Turks are doing this, the Qataris, but these are all our allies. And America is the global hegemon here, right? So if America's not telling them to stop, then isn't it pretty obvious there's only one other explanation? This is an American program. And the fact that the Saudis are sending a bunch of money and guns amounts to not very plausible deniability, and that's about all, right? And Flint Leverett said to me, right. That's right. They know what they're doing. Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Michael Flynn, they said in 2012 they knew what they were doing. The al-Nusra Front, the reported fact that al-Qaeda in Iraq had crossed over into Syria from Iraq and were waging violent attacks was already known in 2011. In the very beginning of 2012, as Hillary Clinton said, again, in the very beginning of 2012, I think this is actually, you know what, I think I used to think it was March, but it's actually late February 2012 when Hillary said,
we know al-Qaeda, Zawahiri is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting al-Qaeda in Syria?
Right, and the answer
Hamas
is
Hamas is now supporting the opposition.
Oh, shut up about Hamas. No, not Hamas. I mean, they may have endorsed it, but that's not their war. But it sure as hell is al-Qaeda and Iraq's war. And when you hear about ISIS versus Nusra, they both claim Osama bin Laden. It's just ISIS doesn't want to listen to Ayman al-Zawahiri anymore. But it's still, we're still talking about al-Qaeda in Iraq. Zarqawi, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's organization that he created after George W. Bush invaded and overthrew the secular Sunni Baathists. In fact, a year, more than a year and a half after the war began. Year and three quarters after the war began, Zarqawi finally signed up with al-Qaeda, declared his allegiance to Osama. But anyway, ISIS and al-Nusra are the same thing. You listen to them crying about Russian intervention, which I'm against, but you listen to the war party crying about it. They're saying, they swore that they would only attack ISIS. Huh? Don't you mean ISIS and al-Nusra? Or, oh, we're rehabilitating al-Nusra and they're the moderates, huh? Well, they are the army of conquest. You know, Mitchell Prothero said on the show, it's true about al-Nusra that they play well with others. They do not act the way that al-Qaeda in Iraq acted in 07 and 08 in that way. They try to play nice with the other groups that are fighting against Assad. But, of course, the other side of that is those other groups are more than happy to ally with al-Qaeda. Remember when Hillary tried to create all the governments in exile in Qatar back in 2012, 2011 and 12, all the friends of Syria and all that? As soon as they would create one of these fake governments to represent the opposition, they would immediately turn around and endorse the al-Nusra Front, which at that time, that was before ISIS had split off. And because that was their only prayer at legitimacy. I was interviewing David Enders, was reporting from Syria. You know, and I think you can go and find that archive of all through 2011, 12, 13. And David Enders is saying, yeah, I mean, this is al-Qaeda's war. I would ask him the direct parallel with Iraq. In Iraq, you had a Sunni-based insurgency, tribal and Baathist, and just everybody Sunni, basically, were fighting for their lives against the American-backed Shiite militias, kicking them, ethnically cleansing them. Not ethnically, but they're all Arabs, but, you know, sectarianly cleansing them from all where they had lived and all that kind of thing. But Zarqawi and those guys got all the public relations, right? It's the foreign terrorists, Jordanians and Egyptians and bin Ladenite foreign terrorists who have come and are causing all the trouble. The Iraqis love us. We're fighting for the Iraqi people, never mind any distinction any finer than that. And that wasn't true, right? In reality, they would admit from time to time Al-Qaeda in Iraq was only the smallest part of the Sunni insurgency against the U.S. and the Shia in the Iraq War II. And so I would always ask that. David Enders, I've been interviewing him since Iraq War II in 2005. And so I would ask him, hey, David, remember how you always told me that Al-Qaeda in Iraq was the smallest part of the Sunni insurgency back in 2005, 6, 7, right? And he would say, yep. And I would say, well, how about in Syria? What are the proportions like there? And he says, completely inverted. The whole thing is Al-Qaeda's war. They dominate the field. They always have. They always were the whole time. And, you know, I don't know. I know it's a bit redundant, but I know there are also new people listening who just can't get their head around it without a whole hell of a lot of evidence.
Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria. The Turks were great friends, the Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. They were so determined to take down Assad, they poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens, thousands of tons of weapons.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for being here. I'm Scott Horton. Our first guest today is our friend Yusuf Butt. He is a senior scientific advisor to the British American Security Information Council. That's BASIC in London. He is a nuclear physicist, a legit one. Not just some crank who claims he's one to the Washington Post, which unquestionably repeats it. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Yusuf?
Good. Good to be here.
Everybody knows I'm talking about David Albright, who he never apologized, but he did have to stop calling himself a scientist, you know. Anyway, hey, happy to have you here. Everybody, you should know, I don't know if you do, but there's this great blog called armscontrollaw.com. It's written by a guy named Dan Joyner. And he's got a lot of great stuff on Iran specifically in here, what I know of. And oftentimes he has guest posts like this one from our friend Yusuf Butt. And this one is called Elephant Not in the Room. Whither the mythological Parchin explosion chamber? Great question. What happened was the IAEA went to Parchin and they inspected the suspicious room, I guess adjacent to the pink tarp, which was actually just insulation, but anyway, and they went in there and there was no explosion chamber. And so you're asking where did it go, but of course, you know, the obvious answer is, well, the sneaky devils took it apart and got it out of there. So, you know, evidence of absence or absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. How do you like that?
Story on Parchin is that there's supposed to be this big chamber where they conducted experiments to do with related to nuclear weapons, and was a few years of controversy leading up to this visit, and finally the IAEA gets in there, and it turns out that they didn't see the chamber. Now the IAEA has been twice before to Parchin; they went to different buildings. And they also did not see any chamber or any suspicious activity or any trace of nuclear materials. So you know, at this point you begin to wonder, after they've been to three different sites and have not found anything suspicious, you know, what exactly is going on. And, you know, my feeling is, like a lot of the other so-called evidence, not all of it, but like much of it, this appears to be something that is not very trustworthy.
All right. Now, so, okay, that's the Occam's razor explanation, is that, yeah, the whole thing was made up by the Israelis, just like the smoking laptop and the rest of this so-called possible military dimensions. And why should anybody believe any of these accusations when we've all read Gareth Porter's book? We all know this is a manufactured crisis about a nuclear weapons program that never existed. So get over it. On the other hand, though, there's a great counterfactual that you can't disprove, I think, maybe, that they could have had a chamber and got rid of it.
Well, you know, that's what the ISIS think tank has been putting forward, that they somehow cut this big chamber up and smuggled it out. But there's a great post by Robert Kelly, who's actually a weapons engineer and a remote was leading the remote sensing lab of the DOE at Nellis Air Force Base, and he says there's no way you could cut this up and sneak it out, just given the dimensions of it and the amount of you know, amount of trucks, et cetera, that would be needed to cart away the debris, given that there's monitoring by U.S. satellites, their radar satellites, as well as the multispectral satellites. So even at night, even during bad weather, you can look through and you can monitor the site, and you can be sure that they were monitoring this site 24/7. So basically, ISIS is wrong that you could smuggle out this huge chamber. I mean, this is the size of a double-decker London bus, you know. Those are the rough dimensions of the thing. And it's made out of solid stainless steel, and it's got a huge concrete collar around it. So it's not something you can just put in your pocket and walk out of.
Hmm. Yeah, especially when it comes to the concrete, Kelly shows an example of the kind of rebar matrix, reinforcement,
right,
steel bars that would have had to have been then filled with concrete in order to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people are familiar with, like, if you're going in a deconstruction site, you know, where they're breaking down one of these buildings and they have that huge crane outside and they're smashing it in like this pneumatic hammer. That's the kind of, you know, that's the kind of devices you need to take this thing apart. So it's not, and this is especially reinforced, like even much more than normal building. So, you know, you'd need to take in one of those cranes and you'd need to take out the material finally. And there's no evidence that that happened.
Yeah. I mean, the funny joke is that they could have ever put this thing together there in the first place without the Americans knowing. You know, as
well, I mean, there may be chambers at Parchin. I mean, the people do use explosion chambers, but this specific large size one that they're saying was specifically for having to do with nuclear weapons testing, the evidence just is not coming together. I mean, this is the third time the IAEA went into Parchin and has not found anything suspicious. Now, we are waiting on the results of the swipe testing where they test for trace nuclear material. So it could be something comes up. I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But certainly this chamber is not there. So whatever comes up is not related to the specific thing that the PMD file was so concerned with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that all 150 million people on the so-called right in America missed the fact that the IAEA was allowed right into Parchin, that there was no 24-day delay of dragging their feet like in the gigantic fake talking point scandal that they had drummed up in opposition to this deal. That this was the only place, basically, where the worry was that they could delay and delay and delay up to 24 days. And yet they said, yeah, come on in, even before implementation day has even begun. They had the director of the agency and all his scientists to come out and look at the damn thing.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and that delay actually doesn't apply to Iran declared nuclear facilities anyway, just it basically applies to anywhere in the country that might be suspicious that they might want to look at. So, yeah, you're right. And so, they walked in and the director of the IAEA was there and there was no chamber. And, swipe samples were taken by the Iranians and will be sent to sent for processing and we'll see what turns up. But, again, like I said, whatever does, if anything does turn up, it's not related to this chamber because there is no chamber that we've seen so far. So, there we are. It just, you can add this to the long list of fake concerns like the Associated Press graphs, which myself and Brent Deloki Varese at Monterey Institute debunked. And, the polonium-210, the ring magnets, and on and on.
No, keep going. Keep going.
Any concerns? I can't off the top of my head. That's all I have right now. but there's a list of concerns that come up and then they like fade away because they're not real concerns and nobody's really bothered by it at the end.
See, that's the most important point of all of this, right? Is that it really doesn't matter whether any of this is true. What matters is that all of these accusations make for great accusations on the day the accusations are made. And that's all that matters is just politics, not science or truth.
Yeah, if David Sanger and other people pick it up and put it in the premier newspaper without, bothering to check with any real experts, the propaganda is done. Yep.
Yeah. And there's huge proportions, maybe a solid plurality of Americans who believe Iran already has nuclear weapons. Well, they've been told that they're making them for 20 years. They got to have some by now, right?
that's the problem with propaganda, Now the public thinking on it is so biased because, that's all that keeps getting leaked out in the press is these concerns and these concerns and these concerns, but when you push people on the concerns, it's all unauthenticated evidence or stuff that has alternate explanations. So, you mentioned, keep going. So there was the exploding bridge wire detonators, which was a concern before, and these could be used as triggers for nuclear weapons to synchronize, the various detonations around the sphere so that there's incoming shockwave. But there's also other explanations why a country might use exploding bridge wire detonators, and that's to do with their oil industry. So, these things have alternate explanations, but, if you could just keep saying Iran, X, and possible nuclear weapons, and, the end has been achieved that you wanted.
Yep. And you know what? Even if we just stuck to accusations by the MEK that didn't pan out, it would take the rest of the hour or something, for the tunnels outside Tehran and the big vault door. And they had one in the Sunday Times a few years ago where supposedly they would just take a core of a sphere of uranium and just cut grooves in it and then just line those grooves with detonation cord and then just set that off. And that would nuke your whole city, they said in the Sunday Times. And there's a million of them.
Could you repeat that? I could not hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I might have been mumbling. There was one in the Sunday Times where they claimed, this is a few years ago, where they claimed that they would just take a uranium sphere and just carve grooves into it all around it and then just lay det cord in there and then just set it off that way. And that would blow up your town with an atom bomb or maybe turn off all electricity in the world forever or whatever we're supposed to be afraid.
Oh yeah, no, I'm not familiar with that, but it could be. I'd have to look at it.
Yeah. No, I mean there are a whole bunch of those. Gordon Prather was really getting a laugh out of that one. I remember specifically cutting the grooves, laying det cord in the grooves of a uranium sphere. I mean, come on, you could look this up on Wikipedia and do better than that. Come on. Anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, hey, I'll let you go. Thanks very much for coming back on the show. You just appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah. Bye bye.
All right, y'all, that is Yosef, but he, I never pronounce anybody whose name is Yosef correctly, sorry. Here he is at armscontrollaw.com, elephant not in the room, wither, the mythological Parchin explosion chamber. He is a nuclear physicist and senior scientific advisor to the British American Security Information Council in London. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, I'm sorry, guys. I can't help myself. Rand Paul is on CNN right now. I got to pipe it in. They're talking foreign policy. Oops, wrong button.
Careful about the U.S. getting involved in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, other international hotspots.
But the interesting thing is kind of the opposite of isolationism. I'm for diplomatic engagement. The people like Carly Fiorina, they want to diplomatically isolate us and not have any discussions with Putin. I think that is very much a mistake. So I'm for diplomatic engagement. I am for being involved, and I am for saying, you know what, let's be very careful that we don't do something rash that might start World War III. And let's also realize from history how we got to this point. Saddam Hussein, once he was toppled, made Iran stronger. Iran and Iraq are now allies. They're also allies with Syria. Now they're allied with Russia. So I would argue that the Iraq war was a mistake, and it actually enabled Russia to become stronger in the region. And that's what we need to think about before we topple another dictator. What are the unintended consequences of toppling dictators in the Middle East?
If you were elected president on a domestic issue, what, if anything, would you do to tighten up gun control issues in the United States?
Nothing. I think it's a terrible tragedy, and, you know, my heart goes out to the families. I've got a couple kids in college.
You know he's going to say nothing on that. He's at least going to be good on guns, right? I'm going to avert my eyes just in case. Let's stick to the point. Right before it came back from break, y'all, he was saying, get out of Afghanistan. And he was saying it in that right-wing way where, let them defend themselves. We have too long. We've defended them from too long, and they're lazy. They don't want to defend themselves since we're defending them for them. And this kind of crap, which is very disingenuous, I think. But I'll take it. Hell, I don't care if you call it a victory. Just get the hell out of there. And in fact, Rand had signed on a letter saying that we should stay in Afghanistan after 2014, you know, to participate in counterterrorism operations and this kind of crap. And he didn't say that. He just said we should be out of there just now on CNN, right before we came back from break. And then on the Syria thing, yeah, they're still talking about guns, I think. On the Syria thing, they asked him, I think you caught most of that. What was it about the Syria thing that you missed that he said? It was just about how the first thing he said, Blitzer said, what would you do about Russia in Syria? And he said, the first thing I would do is I would communicate with them. Not like Carly Fiorina, who says we shouldn't even be talking with the Russians, which is insane. And so that's pretty good, man. You know what? That's why I can't get over the fact. Because first of all, you know he knows better because of who his dad is. You know he knows how to access Ron Paul's antiwar.com archive there. We run all of his foreign policy stuff. All of it. Original.antiwar.com/Paul. Just read that and learn it good. You don't have to mimic it. Learn it. It's right. It's true. So he could be really great, man, if he would just quit with the compromise. I mean, remember when he announced for president, he announced in front of an aircraft carrier. He's been doing this whole, I'm pretty right wing too, huh? Saying hawkish things about Russia. coming out against the Iran deal. But I can't help every day thinking he could change his mind. He could understand that the reason he's at 2% is because he's not brave. The reason his father was at 6 or whatever was because at least he was brave and honest. And the reason he wasn't higher is because TV called him crazy. Oh, he's your crazy old uncle. You're crazy. Crazy, kooky old Ron. Derp, 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 derp. But Rand doesn't have that reputation, and not because he has no principle. I mean, really, Ron, it was just because he would talk about gold or whatever, and they just didn't understand. And just because he is old, his hair's silver or whatever. But just that kind of character, caricature, doesn't really fit on Rand. But he could get out there and, yeah, it was sort of like he was doing there on Blitzer, only with a little more, and fight about it. I like how he fought with Fiorina about it. That should be a fight. That should be a huge fight. Anyway, I don't know. Believe me, I'm the most disappointed in Rand. But also, I can't get over it, though. And I know a lot of people are like, why are you even paying attention to him? Why are you even talking about him on the show? Why does he even interest you anymore? He already showed you his true colors years ago. You said it all along before anybody else, so why are you still talking about it? Well, because of stuff like that, man. He could be the anti-war Republican and attack the right from the right. And that's such an important thing to do, to get through to the minds of people. World Empire is a big government program, and it's a failure, and it's expensive, and it's bad economics, just like all government programs, only it's the worst one and soaked in Olympic-sized swimming pools full of the blood of innocents. And stop pretending it's not. For God's sake, man, we've been at war, and never even mind, you know, Iraq War 1.5 during the Clinton years, which was bloody as hell. But we've been at war for 14 years running. Still lost Afghanistan now. I mean, this whole time, and now more. That was the first one. Operation Enduring Failure forever on your dime. Forever. Yeah, we're going to rule engine country. That's right. The middle part of North America is going to rule Eurasia forever. Because that makes perfect mathematical sense, doesn't it? We've been doing this way too long. So anyway, that's my advice to Rand. Quit half-assing it. Close down all global bases now. We don't need a world empire at all. You want to make America great again? How about let's stop blowing $1 trillion a year on militarism? How about let's stop drafting with these artificially high wages, all the brightest engineers and scientists out of free market jobs and into designing and implementing weapons for mass murdering helpless civilians in faraway lands? You have no idea what militarism costs. $1 trillion, that's just the money spent. Bazillions of dollars is the money never created, the wealth never created. Anyway, get out there and kick their ass, man. Call Mike Huckabee a socialist. You go, you know what? Mike Huckabee is a socialist on everything. He's a socialist on all the transfer payments. He wants these Manhattan Project government programs to solve all our healthcare woes and all this stuff. He's basically like the Christian socialists out of Germany, kind of, right? He's a right, or I don't know how they are theologically with forcing Jesus to come back sooner and all that, but he's like a right-wing born-again on some things, but he's a big government socialist on everything, and especially war. And then just attack them all. Jeb Bush, Donald Trump, all these guys are big government socialists on the empire issue. And then let them explain how they ain't. You know, he did a good job of turning the isolationism thing around there, right? So call them all Wilsonians. Or, well, people don't know what that means. Call them all Clintonians. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is Dan Sanchez. He runs the Mises Academy at the Ludwig von Mises Institute at Mises.org. And you can find his website at dansanchez.me. And he is our newest regular columnist at antiwar.com. This one is called Seize the Chaos, Israel, the Neocons, and Their Bloody Blundering Art of War. Welcome back to the show. Dan, how are you?
Great. Great to be here, Scott.
Good, good. Very happy to have you back on here. Let's see here. Where was I going to start? I was going to start, I know. I'll just ask you, who's David Wormser?
David Wormser is a very influential neoconservative. He is a protege of Richard Perle and also Douglas Feith. And he played an instrumental role in the buildup to the Iraq War. He was everywhere. He was at the Department of State helping John Bolton. He was in the vice president's office helping Sith Lord Dick Cheney. He was, and he was in the Pentagon in Feith's office of,
special plans.
It was actually in the counter-terror.
Oh, right,
team. Mm-hmm. And that's where he was, gathering all the, fanciful yarn to string together to, from basically trawling through the CIA's trash, to try to, connect Al-Qaeda with Saddam Hussein.
Mm. I always forget that. I always, because I know it was Michael Maloof, but now I always forget that David Wormser, he really was all over the place. The Counterterrorism Policy Evaluation Group. Can you come up with a more boring title for a little office full of liars trying to lie you into war?
Right. And he wrote two really important memos in 1996, so 7 years before the Iraq War. And the first one is more famous. It's called A Clean Break. And that's famous for being sort of a plan for the Iraq War, sort of the, you know, premeditated murder. And in Clean Break, basically he's making it's a memo to Israel, to Netanyahu, who was starting his first premiership at the time, for a new strategy. A clean break from the past he wanted to make. And so he had no use for the comprehensive peace plans that they were trying to do before. That he wanted instead a balance of power strategy. So instead of trying to make peace with all of their neighbors, he just wanted to have a pragmatic peace with just some of the neighbors for the purpose of overthrowing and rolling back other neighbors, so just hostility and antagonism to the other neighbors. So at the time, the allies of choice were Turkey and Jordan, and he wanted to use them to attack basically Iraq, Syria, Iran, and Hezbollah. And the first step that he wanted to take was regime change in Iraq. And what's interesting is that that was only a means to an end, that the chief benefit of overthrowing Iraq for Wormser was to what he said, weakening, containing, and even rolling back Syria. So like Pat Buchanan said that the road to Damascus ran through Baghdad. And what's interesting is that the road through Damascus was just a pit stop on the way to Beirut, because he said that in a clean break that the main reason to roll back Syria is because Syria challenges Israel on Lebanese soil. And so that's something that a lot of people don't realize, is that Lebanon was sort of the main objective for a lot of the neocons.
All right. So, and now both of these articles, by the way, are available at my website, A Clean Break, and the second one here, the companion piece, Coping with Crumbling States. And both Dan Sanchez's articles are available at antiwar.com. The first one is called Clean Break to Dirty Wars, and that's from June 30th. Clean Break to Dirty Wars. And then the latest, again, is Seize the Chaos. And this is more about, and you guys hear me from time to time using the phrase, expedite the chaotic collapse, because that's what Wormser said. What we want to do in Syria is expedite the chaotic collapse. But as you point out here, Syria was not chaotically collapsing. It had to be collapsed from the outside.
Yeah, and the same thing with Iraq. Iraq was, he in Coping with Crumbling States, he thought that both Iraq and Syria were collapsing because of their adoption of Baathism, and more generally, secular Arab nationalism. He said that due to the inherent failings of Arab nationalism, that Baathist states would only fluctuate between repression and anarchy. And so it would start with tyranny, but then it would always eventually collapse. And so he thought that Iraq was on the verge of collapsing, especially after the Gulf War. And he compared it to the situation in World War I. At the time, the Ottoman Empire was known as the sick man of Europe. And no one had any doubt that the Ottoman Empire was going to fall. The only question was who was going to get to despoil the corpse. And so Wormser thought that the Iraq was the sick man of the Middle East, basically. He didn't use that term, but that's what he thought. And he thought that Iraq was either going to become dominated by Jordan, which was a Hashemite monarchy, or Baathist Syria. And he wanted it to go to Jordan, because basically Jordan is a bought and paid for Western client, dependent on hundreds of millions of dollars from the United States every year. And so he wanted regime change in Iraq, and specifically he wanted to put one of the king of Jordan's relatives on the throne as a king of Iraq. He called it the Hashemite option, because the royal house of Jordan is called, they're called the Hashemites. Mm-hmm. And so he thought that if Jordan were to hold sway over Iraq, that they would be able to, that there would still be a chaotic collapse, but this would expedite it, and the Jordan would help manage the chaotic collapse. And then there would be an axis of Iraq would join Turkey and Jordan and the West and Israel, and they would isolate Syria. So that was the end game for Syria, and that would help hasten Syria's own collapse, which again he thought was inevitable, or he claimed was inevitable because of Arab nationalism, but this would expedite that chaotic collapse, like you say.
And now what's funny here is, and I had forgotten this, honestly, it's been, I guess, way too many years since I read the second one, Coping with Crumbling States, that you say he mentions Ahmed Chalabi in there. 1996, he says, don't worry, my buddy Chalabi tells me that the Shia of Iraq, who will, once we get rid of Saddam, who will inherit the country, they'll just love to bow down and be told what to do by a Hashemite king, or at least by him. That was their compromise. We'll have Chalabi instead of a king. And that was clearly, obviously, the neocon plan all the way up through the beginning of the war, was to put Chalabi in there. And then he'll be completely pro-Jordan, and then, well, I guess now we got to go to the break. When we get back, we'll find out in David Wormser's ridiculous daydream here, what was supposed to happen to Iran once America got rid of his worst enemy, their worst enemy, Saddam Hussein, and the Baathists in Iraq. It's Dan Sanchez from antiwar.com. The article today is Seize the Chaos. We'll be right back. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Dan Sanchez from antiwar.com and Mises.org. This one is called Seize the Chaos, and it's about the neocons' plans, a clean break and coping with crumbling states. David Wormser, and then, of course, a clean break is also co-signed. I forget if coping is, but a clean break is co-signed by Richard Perle and Douglas Feith. And other prominent neocons, the guys that ended up founding the Project for a New American Century. And of course, they sold the thing as though, Iraq is going to be such a democratic paradise under Chalabi and pro-Chalabi Shiite control that it's going to, we won't even need to attack Iran because it's going to make the Iranian people so jealous of all the freedom in Iraq. They're going to overthrow the government and make themselves a pro-American democracy themselves. And if that doesn't work, we'll bomb them and we'll go ahead and take the war to them. But they really didn't imagine these neocons, I don't think, and especially from reading your piece, they couldn't have imagined, even though it was the most obvious thing in the world, that the Iranians would be the ones inheriting the power in Iraq. No wonder George Bush couldn't start the war against Iran. He found himself immediately surrounded by and fighting for the most Iran-loyal factions among Shiite power in the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party. He had no choice but to do their bidding, or, you know, because his guys were completely surrounded by their guys. They were the majority who stood by and allowed the invasion from Kuwait because they wanted to see Saddam gone so that they could inherit the power for themselves. So, boy, did Chalabi lure these pro-Israel neocons right into a trap, it sounds like, Dan.
Yeah, it's really convoluted, the whole plan. I mean, the original plan was that the Hashemite king of Jordan, that he would be able to use his influence over a particular Shiite cleric, and that that cleric would in turn influence the Shiites of Lebanon, of Iran, and of Syria, and of Iraq, too. And the first three, to have them, you know, overthrow Assad, overthrow the Islamic Republic, and kick out Hezbollah. You know, he actually thought that, and but then of course, what my theory is that by the time the Iraq War came around, the Hashemite option of installing a royal despot just wasn't going to fly, because it's one thing to make that happen from behind the scenes, but installing a king at the end of a high-profile American war, that just wasn't going to fly. And so what I see Chalabi as representing is a sort of a democratic Hashemite option, because Wormser called Chalabi a Hashemite confidant, and so they thought that he would, you know, bring Iraq close to Jordan and would give them all sorts of goodies, would build a pipeline from Mosul to Haifa, from the oil fields of Iraq to a refinery and a port in Israel. Just completely ridiculous. And as it turned out, he was just as much an agent of Iran as he was a Hashemite confidant. Hmm.
Well, and of course, we saw the beginning of the redirection in 2005. Zalmay Khalilzad was the first one to say, no, we need to redirect back to the Sunnis. And they put that off for a couple of years. They had to at least get Saddam lynched and buried first. And then they turn around and they back the awakening. And then you bring up here the redirection, the article by Hirsch, which I'd ask you to explain that. And then, as you say here, they really doubled down on that same policy after the Arab Spring broke out. Basically, oops, we gave 2/3 of Iraq to Iran, so now let's take out all the rest of Iran's allies as our consolation prize for our massive own goal here.
Yeah, if it wasn't such a bloody tragedy, it would be hilarious how, to the extent that Wormser's plans backfired, because he envisioned that Iraq would join a pro-Israel alliance, including Turkey and the West and Jordan. And it ended up being what they call a Shiite crescent, where Iraq was closer than ever to exactly the people that they wanted to isolate, was closer than ever to Iran. And so they thought that it was part of a Shiite crescent extending from Iran through Baghdad, through into Syria, because Assad is technically a Shiite, even though he's very secular, and into Hezbollah's turf in Lebanon. And so that what the redirection was about was trying to undermine and counter that menacing Shiite crescent. And so they found allies in Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states, and still including Turkey and Jordan. And so they did expand the axis, but by including these Gulf states, and they had their own reasons for hating the Shiite crescent, that because they're the Sunni Wahhabis of Saudi Arabia, they have a lot more in common with ISIS and Al-Qaeda than they do with Iran and Syria. And so they became allies of convenience, and the United States helped orchestrate this redirection of policy of actually funding Mujahideen, extremist Salafist Mujahideen in Lebanon and Syria and Iran to try to undermine these regimes. Even though it was Salafists, it was jihadists just like them, who knocked down the Twin Towers. That the whole reason why we're over in the Middle East in the first place is because of 9/11. And but as early as 2007, the redirection was underway, and they were supporting Mujahideen. And then, like you say, in the Arab Spring, then the redirection went into overdrive, and they started backing jihadists in Libya and backing jihadists in Syria, trying as hard as they could through really supporting the insurgency to overthrow Assad, even though, as they recognized, as was revealed in a DIA report, that the DIA, the American government, fully realized that doing so could result in a Salafist principality, they called it, basically what became ISIS. They foresaw that something like this could happen. And sure enough, you know, by 2014, just last year, ISIS took over all northwestern Iraq, and then Al-Qaeda is taking over much of Syria, Syrian Al-Qaeda, which is al-Nusra Front, and ISIS is taking over much of Syria. And they're still doing the same policy. They're still pursuing the redirection, funding these Islamists. And what's fascinating about Wormser's piece is that it reveals the logic behind that. That Wormser, even back in 1996, he addressed the whole issue of Islamic fundamentalists versus Baathists like Assad and like Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi in Libya. And he just flat out rejected any kind of even a temporary detente with the Ba'athists and the Arab nationalists, just for the sake of rolling or as a bulwark against the fundamentalist tide. He rejected that. He wanted first priority to be Arab nationalism, and fundamentalism that can be dealt with later. And so you would have think that, okay, that was 96. Well, the logic, the calculation must have changed, at least for America, after 9/11, but it didn't. It certainly didn't for Israel. And so I have these quotes. One of the quotes that you play a lot in your show, which is just key, Michael Oren, where he makes it crystal clear that Wormser's priorities, that number one enemy is Arab nationalism.
Well, here, let me go ahead and play it here.
If we have to choose the lesser of evils here, the lesser evil is the Sunnis over the Shiites.
Well, that's not very good. You know, the clip is not supposed to clip like that. Let's try that again.
If we have to choose the
It's not supposed to skip like that either.
If we have to choose the lesser of evils here, the lesser evil is the Sunnis over the Shiites. It's an evil, believe me, it's a terrible evil. Again, they've just taken out 1,700 former Iraqi soldiers and shot them in a field. But who are they fighting against? They're fighting against the proxy with Iran that's complicit in the murder of 160,000 people in Syria. You can just, you know, do the math. And again, one side is armed with suicide bombers and rockets. The other side has access to military nuclear capabilities. So from Israel's perspective, if there's got to be an evil that's going to prevail, you know, let the Sunni evil prevail.
All right. Again, that's Michael Oren, the former ambassador, Israel's former ambassador to the United States there. And we're going over time anyway, so I thought I'd go ahead and play the clip as long as you're going to mention it.
Sure, yeah. And now he's a member of parliament. And what's amazing about that clip is that, like you mentioned before, that when he talks about the Sunni evil, he calls, when he references a specific mass execution that ISIS did. So he was specifically referring to ISIS when he was saying, let the Sunni evil prevail. He was saying, let ISIS prevail. And what's horrible about that clip, too, is that he is putting all the blame of all the deaths at that point in the Syrian civil war on Assad, as if he just, you know, massacred all those people. But in reality, you know, I even read over half of the deaths are Syrian military deaths fighting these Islamist-led insurgency. And then another big portion of it are the Islamists itself. And so it's only a particular portion of that Assad has killed civilians, don't get me wrong, and that's totally evil. But, he's completely distorting the record there to try to make Assad look like, you know, like an absolute demon, and make him seem much worse than ISIS and Al-Qaeda.
And he makes it sound like Iran is sitting on a pile of atom bombs and is giving them out to Syria and to Hezbollah.
Right. And like you and Gareth Porter have covered that, you know, that's just nonsense. That's just all fabricated nonsense.
Yeah. So, okay, now... there's Michael Oren. That's explaining the Israeli position there. And you linked to this Jerusalem Post article as well, where he says, hey, from the very beginning, we wanted Assad gone. There are other quotes where Jody Ruderin in the New York Times quotes an Israeli military strategist saying, well, we just want neither side to win. You know, like Kissinger said about the Iran-Iraq war, make sure both sides lose and just keep them hemorrhaging to death, I think was the way that they put it there. But
yeah, didn't
of course, it's
say,
the civilians doing most of the hemorrhaging.
Right. And then wasn't there a famous quote, some Israeli official said, let them both bleed or something like that?
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, from the New York Times. Yeah, let them hemorrhage to death actually was a more accurate way that he put it there. And so now... yeah, I think that it is very important to note, as you did there. I want to go back to what you said about how Wormser says, more or less, yeah, but what about Al-Qaeda? well, never mind that. The Baathists are worse. We got to get rid of them. And then, as you say, even after all the attacks of the 1990s and September 11th and the beginning of the war and the overthrow of Iraq and the destruction, the absolute catastrophe in from the neocons' point of view, too, of giving two-thirds of Iraq over to the Iranians. And now, I guess, it makes more sense that, you know, since the Baathists in Syria are actually, it's a minority-ruled dictatorship like in Iraq, but this time they're backed by the Shiites, and the fighters are among the Sunni majority who are trying to overthrow them. So, as Obama told Goldberg, that's right, Jeffrey Goldberg, this would be a great way to take Iran down a peg. He didn't mention, they're often way too polite to include Iraq in the Shiite crescent. He didn't mention that, you know, as a consolation prize for the disastrous, policy of the last decade, which you lied us into, Jeffrey. But anyway, he said, that's right, Jeffrey. If we, got rid of Assad, that would be a great way to help diminish Iranian power, in the region. And obviously, you know, meaning in support for Hezbollah and all the rest of it. So, even Obama, you know, is on the record in The Atlantic explaining that this is basically the policy. And then I have to admit, I first saw these quotes in your article before I read the New York Times thing. So I already knew what was in there. And then I read the New York Times article, Dan, and the New York Times article is, as Syria reels, Israel looks to expand settlements in the Golan Heights. And again, this is by Jody Ruderin as well. And, man, there's some shocking quotes in here. I'm actually pretty surprised at some of the stuff that they included in this article to explain to us, New York Times readers, us poor pitiful souls. It's pretty bad. Even after I already knew what was in there, I was still kind of shocked reading this article. So, and this takes us back to Michael Oren, the former ambassador whose audio we just played here. Explain, yeah, please.
Michael Oren really said, Wormser would have been, you know, would be so happy to hear this, saying that, well, you know, the Golan Heights, it's not like it's going to be a part of any kind of peace deal now because, you know, who would we have peace with? Because the thing is that, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, that that Israel conquered the Golan Heights from Syria in 1967. And it's always been an issue that it's, by the international community, it's considered illegally occupied. And so that's always been put on the table by different factions as different parties as potentially part of a peace deal with Syria. And as we discussed, that Wormser hates the comprehensive peace process, and in particular, the component of it of land for peace. He hates land for peace, even if it's land that was, you know, illegitimately conquered. And so what has happened is that by precipitating and expediting the chaotic collapse in Syria, you know, they've given themselves an excuse to just completely take the Golan Heights off the table because, well, you know, you're just mired in chaos now. How are, you know, you're not going to be able to keep it secure, and you're not going to be able to do anything reasonable with it. And so that's what I mean by the title of Seize the Chaos, is that, you know, they create, Israel and the neocons create this chaos, and then they seize on it as an excuse for, you know, furthering their strategic goals. And Oren, when he says that, when he makes the case for the settlements, he outright makes a Lebensraum argument, what the Nazis used as a living space argument, saying that, well, we need places to build. And, you know, the world doesn't want us to build on the West Bank because that's illegally occupied also. So we got to build here. And like you say, it was so blatant, and it's really a surprise that the New York Times would actually include that.
Yeah, I mean, that's really something else, especially from the guy who's on the record, you know, promoting the jihadist side of this war. And as you mentioned, and there's a link in here to And people are shocked by this when I tell them. They say, I hadn't heard that one. Are you sure? And I say, I'm sure. Check out the record there of Israeli medical care for the al-Nusra Front. It's not just in spirit. It is actual aid and comfort to America's enemies. Provided by the Israelis, creating this situation. And then, as you say, using that as the excuse. And, you know, I'm sorry. I don't know. Everybody knows this. It should go without saying, but maybe it doesn't, that it was America and the Allies' defeat of the Nazis at the end of World War II when they founded the whole international system. And they said, yeah, we know this is where nation states come from. But from now on, it's illegal to invade your neighbors and conquer them and move your civilian populations into their land and conquer it and take it. All frontiers are basically hereby closed, other than, you know, if you want to negotiate. But we will not have this kind of, you know, this is illegal. And why? Because Hitler did it and gave killing the natives and taking their property a really bad name for all time. That was why.
Right. Right, exactly.
So, and never mind the, you know, all the different levels of fait accompli here. I think, well, it's a fact that all the Arab states and the PLO and PLA and everybody else have said that they would recognize 67 borders and they could live in peace if they would just make peace with their neighbors. It doesn't have to be this way at all. Except, no, that's okay. They want to conquer more territory. That's why we can't have a treaty with them, is because it's illegal. There's a law that says we can't have a treaty, invite any country into NATO or anything like that, a defense treaty, if they don't have permanent and resolved borders. And the Israelis refuse to declare permanent borders because they ain't done yet. The Persian Gulf is real far east from here, man. Greater Israel's got a long way to go.
And what's so reckless, what really strikes me as just so unbelievably reckless about this, their policy, not only for the, just for the sake of Americans and for our troops that end up going through these wars and for the sake of the people who are actually bombed over there, but for the sake of the security of the people of Israel too, that they are so hell-bent on adopting Wormser's priorities of secular Arab nationalism is enemy number one and fundamentalism is a distant second, that they would ideally like, you know, a Hashemite king or some kind of stable sock puppet ruling all of the Levant. But failing that, they would rather have complete chaos, just complete, you know, extremists attacking armies and militias, fighting militias, just be completely surrounded with chaos, than to have even a single national Arab nationalist state with our independent rational leadership and a competent military. Like they don't want that at all, because that would, you know, that they would, you know, might create some kind of obstacle, some kind of real obstacle to its regional ambitions. But in terms of the Israeli people, you know, forget, you know, grand geopolitical strategy. In terms of the security of the Israeli people, I can't imagine how they could be actually more secure surrounded by chaos in that way. I just don't, it's unfathomable.
Yeah. Well, it's just like the difference between the American people and our government and the Israeli people and theirs. What's in their state interest and their military industrial complex's interest is not necessarily in the interest of the people there at all. But, you know, the worst are full of passionate intensity and all that. Thanks very much, Dan. Great piece of work here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott, and thank you for everything you've taught me. I'm a regular listener, avid listener.
That's nice to hear. Talk to you soon.
Okay.
That, everybody, is Dan Sanchez. He's at Mises.org. He runs the Mises Academy there, the Ludwig von Mises Institute. And here he is at antiwar.com. Seize the chaos. Israel, the neocons, and their bloody, blundering art of war. Check out his previous piece, Clean Break to Dirty Wars, Shattering the Middle East for Israel's Northern Front.